So thank you very much, Nida, for this very kind introduction. I would also like to thank, of course, the Haus der Kulturen der Welt for inviting me once more to this wonderful place. Also thanks to the curatorial team, Anselm, Nida, Paz and Antonia. I would also like to thank a number of other persons who were very much assisting in organizing travels, hotels, anything else, like Sihle Hase, Dunja Salan, Susanne Förster, and I'm afraid that I missed one or two of them. I'm sorry for that. Also, of course, thanks to the translators. Now, it's towards the end of this long day, a presentation that is not directly concerned with the question of Cold War issues, but as Nida already mentioned, I think, or we thought, that this presentation would resonate somehow with a set of references that are made in the exhibition itself, but also in some of the talks we have heard so far. So let me start. In spring 2010, Tate Liverpool presented the exhibition Afro-Modern, Journeys through the Black Atlantic, which successfully endeavored to trace in the field of the visual arts Paul Gilroy's famous argument of the Black Atlantic as a counterculture of modernity. In a corner of the first exhibition room, a specific constellation of two small artworks mounted next to each other struck my attention. A black and white picture of a Dan mask from the Ivory Coast by the famous American photographer Walker Evans, and a pastel drawing by the African-American painter Norman Lewis, who is also in the exhibition here, obviously depicting the same object. Both images were created in 1935 on the occasion of the exhibition African Negro Art at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, which is considered the first major presentation of classical African art in an art museum in the United States. The curators of Afro-Modern, that were Tanja Barson and Peter Gorschlüter, did not further comment on their fascinating juxtaposition of pictures, but the form of presentation figured as a point in itself, raising a number of questions. How did the two artists of different backgrounds, both in terms of race and artistic media, respond to the same objects in one and the same exhibition? What did they respectively see, and how did they interpret the figures and masks on display? What were their expectations when they visited African Negro art in spring 35? Of what sort was their respective encounter with the Dan mask, for instance, and what did they make out of it in their own work? Both of them being roughly at the same age at the time and in an early stage of their career. These questions raised by the confrontation of Walker Evans and Norman Lewis' pieces address a certain blank space in modern art history writing. During the last three decades, there has been much debate about Western practices of collecting, displaying, and describing non-Western art objects. Last but not least, triggered by another MoMA show of 1984, the notorious Primitivism in 20th Century Art, Affinities of the Tribal and the Modern. Anthropologists, artists, and art historians have criticized these practices of collecting, displaying, and so on, as manifestations of a Eurocentric colonialist worldview. They have argued about the proper place for these objects, art museums, ethnographic museum, or their restitution to their source communities. Whereas the literature on the reception of so-called primitive art in white modernism is extensive, the relevance of traditional African art for the formation of black modernisms is still underexposed. While we usually assume that African art has been displaced in Western museums for a wide audience, my presentation tonight focuses on encounters of black artists with African sculpture in such institutions. As I want to point out, the reception and usage of African art objects has been of crucial importance in the cultural production and political interventions of black artists in Europe, Africa, and America throughout the 20th century. My encounter with the two presentations of a Dan mask in the Liverpool exhibition immediately recalled the encounter of a black visitor with an African mask, a black woman, in a museum showcase depicted in the first critical film on the subject of collecting and presenting African art in Western museums. The film Les Statues Meurent Aussi, The Statues Also Die, by French filmmakers Chris Marker and Alain René, a fierce anti-colonialist film essay, was produced in the early 1950s, and this is also included in the exhibition I was at. Is that true? It's not? Okay. It's a pity. The very first sentences of the film's voiceover concern the relation of life and art, art and death. When men die, they enter history. When statues die, they enter art. This botany of death is what we call culture. End quote. But how do the filmmakers describe the transmutation from living statues and masks into dead objects stored in the museum? They state, I quote, an object dies when the living glance trained upon it disappears. In their poetic manner, Marquer and René describe the dying of African art as a loss of contact with the people who were close to it, as an alienation of the material object from the imagination that had been part of its cultural context. The directors comment on the dubious response to African art objects. Maybe we watch a bit of it. They comment on the dubious response to African art objects by European beholders. I quote, we look at it, the mask or the African art, as if it had its reason for being in the pleasure it gives us. And they remind us of the limitations of the primarily aesthetic perspective favored by modern artists and critics in the first half of the 20th century. We find the picturesque there, they say, to name our ignorance with the words, the intentions of the black who created it escape us. Let's have a look at this scene. The beginning of the film, obviously. You see a number of very famous artists, art dealers, museums, museum collections who collaborated on this project. We have sound, or does it start a bit later? Maybe it starts a bit later. I turned off. Oh. Okay. Sound comes a bit later. Yeah.
les hommes sont morts, ils entrent dans l'histoire. Quand les statues sont mortes, elles entrent dans l'art. Cette botanique de la mort, c'est ce que nous appelons la culture. C'est que le peuple des statues est mortel. Un jour, nos visages de pierre se décomposent à leur tour. Une civilisation laisse derrière elle ses traces mutilées comme les cailloux du petit poussé. Mais l'histoire a tout mangé. Un objet est mort quand le regard vivant qui se posait sur lui a disparu. Et quand nous aurons disparu, nos objets iront là où nous envoyons ceux des nègres, au musée. Nous le regardons comme s'il trouvait sa raison d'être dans le plaisir qu'il nous donne. Les intentions du nègre qu'il crée, les émotions du nègre qu'il regarde, cela nous échappe. Parce qu'elles sont écrites dans le bois, nous prenons leurs pensées pour des statues. Et nous trouvons du pittoresque là où un membre de la communauté noire voit le visage d'une culture. C'est son sourire de Reims qu'elle regarde. C'est le signe d'une unité perdue où l'art était le garant d'un accord entre l'homme et le monde. C'est le signe de cette gravité que lui lègue, au-delà des métissages et des bateaux d'esclaves, cette vieille terre des ancêtres, l'Afrique.
Okay, this is a short clip from a 30 minutes film. It is one of the great achievements of this film that the directors do not limit themselves to a critique of the mortification of African art objects by way of their decontextualization. They go on further, reflecting on the thoughts and emotions of a black person who encounters African artifacts in a museum. The key scene is, in this regard, shows a young black woman strolling through a museum collection and facing a showcase with the label African masks. To watch this woman contemplating a mask presented behind a glass window stimulates us to meditate on her feelings and her thoughts vis-à-vis this object. The spoken commentary assists us in reading this encounter of a modern black subject with an object of so-called art nègre. Contrary to the white beholder's focus on form, on the picturesque, as the filmmakers call it, we are told that the member of the black community sees the face of a culture. To her, the mask is the sign of a lost unity where art was the guarantee of an agreement between man and the world, end quote. In Statues Also Die, this confrontation of a black person with African art in the Western Museum becomes the starting point for a much wider critical reflection on the histories of slavery, colonialism, and anti-colonialist struggles. The revolutionary move of the film is thus to be found exactly there, in the interweaving of colonial violence with the appropriation and proud exhibiting of non-Western artworks, but also the interlinkage of liberation movements with the reflexive look of a black museum visitor. I will come back to this film later in the context of post-World War II art practices. For the moment, I consider the film's reasoning on giving a new life to the mortified object of African art in the Western Museum via its contemporary reinterpretation as a starting point for considering a few examples of black art from the modernist era. Let us jump back to the mid-30s, to the case of the Dan mask in the MoMA exhibition. Conceived by Alfred H. Barr, director and co-founder of MoMA, a major apologist of modern art in the US, in close collaboration with exhibition curator James Sweeney, African Negro art was in full accordance with the modernist approach to primitive art. More than 600 objects of African art from European and American collections were presented in the show that claimed to be the most comprehensive of its kind. A comparative look at the displays of African Negro art and the MoMA exhibition Modern Works of Art a few months earlier makes evident that African Negro art represents a culmination point of the early 20th century tendency to look at African artifacts no longer from an anthropological perspective, but to consider them as masterpieces of art, stressing their plastic and aesthetic qualities by isolating them from any functional or cultural context. Walker Evans had been commissioned by the museum to document the objects in African Negro art, a work that resulted in an edition of 17 portfolios comprising 477 images and given the same title as the exhibition. The characteristics of Walker Evans' photographs can be seen in the neutral background of the objects that were evenly lighted, giving no indication of space or scale. They are close-ups of sculptures given in extremely narrow cuttings. As Virginia Lee Webb notes, Evans was, I quote, editing out any elements that might distract the viewer from the subject or be irrelevant to its form, both literally in the print and initially through the lens and by fitting the objects snugly into the frame, end quote. As such, his photographs were considered perfect documents by contemporary critics. So, but what was it that it made these pictures into perfect documents? The techniques applied by Evans exceeded even further the exhibition's isolation and decontextualization of the African objects. His radical isolation of the objects must be seen against the backdrop of the Museum of Modern Art's explicit intention to address not only a white audience, but to reach out to African Americans too. The Evans portfolio was given for free to a couple of major black institutions like Fisk University in Nashville or the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, whereas it was sold to museums like the Victoria and Albert in London or the Trocadero in Paris. Thus, the MoMA distributed a very particular modernist perception of African art to black educational institutions in the US. When Norman Lewis visited the African Negro Art Exhibition, he was a young painter at a crucial point of his early career. Age 25, studying at Columbia University, he was painting in a social realist style, focusing on scenes of everyday life in Harlem. Becoming part of the abstract expressionist movement in the 1940s, when he exhibited his paintings alongside Willem de Kooning and Ed Reinhardt and took part in the artists' sessions at Studio 35 as the only black artist, Lewis always kept a significant position between political activism and abstract art. Lewis' encounter with the African masks took place at the time of his identity formation as a black artist, when he joined or co-founded groups and organizations like the 306 Group or the Harlem Artists Guild. It's in exactly the same year. He became acquainted with painters like Mark Rothko and Adolf Gottlieb, but also mingled with black writers like Claude McKay and Ralph Ellison. In the mid-1930s, the racial segregation of the art world in the US was more permeable than both before and afterwards, during and after the war, the Cold War. There is no evidence of contact, direct contact, at least I didn't find any evidence of contact between Norman Lewis and Walker Evans, but they had mutual friends, such as Mark Toby, and of course they shared their workplace in the museum for some time during the African Negro Art Show. When we have a closer look at Lewis and Evans' depiction of the Dan masks, we are able to discern some significant differences. Evans presents the mask frontally and trimmed into the picture frame. We cannot say whether the mask is hanging, standing, or lying on the ground. Working on his commissioned project, Evans consciously avoided to indicate any light source. The object doesn't cast any shadows. There seems to be no space around it, and the mask appears extremely flat. Its three-dimensional qualities are minimized in favor of a linear designation of the face. Norman Lewis, however, views the mask in a semi-profile and from a bottom view. Light falls in from the left. The mask casts a shadow onto the wall to its right. Contrary to the Walker Evans photo, Louis certainly suggests a mask hanging on the wall. Mouth, nose, chin, and cheeks of the mask are modeled in hues of black, blue, and brown with bright reflections of light. The eye holes seem to recede into the back. One could go on with describing what seems to be obvious, that Louis lends some carnal qualities to the mask, thereby humanizing its appearance and animating it by his depiction of slightly opened eyes and mouth. Just note his interpretation of the nose as round and soft in contrast to Evans' nose in a triangular form. Evans clearly follows a tendency in European modernism to understand the African mask in geometric patterns, as we know it from Picasso, Modigliani, and Lipschitz and others, whereas Louis tends to see the mask as a human face that seems relatively animate. His interpretation is not only humanizing, but also African. The face is distinctly black, both in its coloring as it is, as in its African features. Furthermore, Louis depicts a crucial functional element of the mask, which is hidden in the Evans photograph, making clearly visible the holes that are necessary to fix the mask to the head of its wearer. He makes reference to the performance of the mask in its cultural environment, a reference that was absolutely of no importance to the aestheticizing attitude of both Evans' portfolio and the MoMA exhibition itself. The making of African-American modernism is closely linked to the formation, of course, of a new race consciousness in the early 20th century. As an essential part of this consciousness and the efforts of strengthening it were the diverse forms of reference to Africa and the African heritage of Black Americans. Within this movement of self-empowerment through reconceptualizing Black identity, the occupation with African art was an integral part of the artist's search for a genuine Black expression. During the Harlem Renaissance, after the First World War, the New Negro Movement, as it was called at the time, with its immensely rich production in all cultural fields, the Black preoccupation with African art reached its first peak. An early example is the famous sculpture Ethiopia Awakening by Meta Warwick Fuller, dated 1921, which has been described as, I quote, among the earliest examples of American art to reflect the formal exigencies of an aesthetics based on African sculpture. So this allegorical figure, inspired by Egyptian sculpture and evoking the only non-colonized African country in the work's title, Ethiopia, shows a Black woman with the feature of the artist unwrapping herself from a mummy-like binding. Of Melvin Gray Johnson's painting, Negro Masks, it is known that the depicted masks had been on display in the exhibition Blondieu Theater Arts Collection of Primitive African Art that was organized by Alan Locke and the New Art Circle in New York. Johnson's self-portrait of 1934 presents the painter in a self-reflexive pose against the backdrop of his painting Negro Masks. It seems as if he had removed the African masks from their display in the museum exhibition of a Belgian private collection and secured them to the studio of a modern African-American artist. When we speak about the role of the mask in the making of Black modernism, we have to deal at least with two meanings of the word. There is, of course, the mask as the physical object, the African artifact studied by the Black American artists as a source of inspiration and a reminder of the cultural heritage of the African diaspora. However, as we know from Frantz Fanon and his book Black Skin, White Masks, written in the 1950s, the mask has another meaning of crucial importance for the discourse on Black subjectivity. It is about racist stereotypes and strategies strategic role-playing coerced by colonial power structures. A Black man is forever in combat with his own image, writes Fanon, pointing to the challenge of the black subject to react to the images of him or herself produced by white culture. Fanon was not the first one to address this issue, even if he provided the most thorough analysis of the problem. In a society shaped by racism since centuries, every effort to create a new image of the black had to struggle with firmly established stereotypes in depicting black Americans in this case. Langston Hughes addressed the subject in his poem Minstrel Man of 1925. Because my mouth is white with laughter and my throat is deep with song, you do not think I suffer after I have held my pain so long. Because my mouth is white with laughter, you do not hear my inner cry. Because my feet are gay with dancing, you do not know I die. When we look at the illustrations of Alan Locke's New Negro publications of the same year, then Houston's poem, we encounter these two elements, two embodiments of the mask. Some of the articles, including Locke's own writings, are accompanied by reproductions of African masks from the collection of Albert C. Barnes. Locke calls the young artists, to form a school of Negro art and create such a movement on the basis of close examination and interpretation of the art of the ancestors. At the same time, he speaks about the urgency to tear down the defacing masks that white American culture has put over the image of African Americans. When Locke praises the merits of Winold Rice's sensitive portraits of black individuals that illustrate his publication, he puts it quite clearly. I quote, "Rice has aimed to portray the soul and spirit of a people by the simple but rare process of not forcing an alien idiom upon nature or a foreign convention upon a racial tradition. He has succeeded in revealing some of the rich and promising resources of Negro types," as he says. Art, Locke writes, must discover and reveal the beauty which prejudice and caricature have overlaid. Indeed, at some point, he brings together the two contradictory aspects of the mask, the alienating stereotype on the one hand and the empowering linkage to African art on the other. I quote, there is in the mere knowledge of the skill and the unique mastery of the arts of the ancestors the valuable and stimulating realization that the Negro is not a cultural foundling without his own inheritance. Our timid and apologetic imitativeness and overburdening sense of cultural indebtedness have, let us hope, their natural end in such knowledge and realization. We recognize that in this plea for a new African-American art, the positive reference to one meaning of the mask is part and parcel of the task to fight the other negative meaning of the mask as stereotype and caricature. With his major style, Aaron Douglas, who began working for major black journals such as The Crisis and Opportunity shortly after his arrival in Harlem, gave this double move its definite form. Based on the specific mixture of Art Deco, Expressionism, and Africanist motifs of his teacher Winold Rice, which he elaborated by applying elements of Cubism and Orphism, Douglas created his distinct style of clear-cut shapes and dynamic spaces. On the level of subject matter, he succeeded in linking the African past, if only imagined, to the history of slavery and emancipation, to modern black urban life, and the prosperous future of the race. While he was still working in the studio of Winold Rice, studying with the German painter, Douglas was already aware of the differences between his white teacher's style and his own work as an African-American artist. In a letter to his girlfriend, he describes a moment of excitement when he was executing a drawing of a black man during the night at home that he had begun earlier in the life class of Winold Rice. He writes, "I took my work home and completed it in crayon without the model. Oh, babe, I wish you could see it. It looks exactly as if it had been carved out of wood." As Amy Kirschke notes in her book on Douglas, in describing the work as almost carved out of wood, Douglas was referring to his effort to make his works more purely African or based on African sculpture. We do not know which drawing Douglas was referring to with his writing, but you can compare the cover of The Crisis depicting a black hat to the one Winold Reiss did for the Harlem issue of Survey Graphic in 1925. The drawing is certainly not to be considered one of Douglas's most advanced works, still a young artist at the time, but it demonstrates the close relation to and the emphasized reading of basic forms of carving out an image with concave and convex forms, translated here into the three-dimensional of the flat surface. Compared to the rather schematic paraphrasing of African masks in his teacher's work, Douglas obviously gives new life to this African art form. When we think back to what has been said earlier about the life and death of African art in the film Statues Also Die, the phrase of the living glance trained upon the object surfaces to our mind again. It is of crucial importance that the film by Macaire and René was commissioned by Présence Africaine, the Paris-based African publishing house and magazine, in order to adequately estimate the political agenda behind this Afro-European project of reanimating black masks. Before I continue with two examples from the Cold War period of the 60s and 70s, I'd like to make a footnote on the topicality of this issue, which cannot be reduced to an academic question. Contemporary art in the United States, under recent conditions of racial violence and counter-movements like Black Lives Matter, shows strong interest in early and mid-20th century black arts movements like the Harlem Renaissance, Negritude, and Présence Africaine. With Fahamu Bekou, I give you just one example of a contemporary artist who turns to classic African art and spirituality, but also to its relevance to black modernism. You see in this work where he really makes very concrete references to the cover designs by Winold Reiss and Aaron Douglas. Unlike the counter-primitivist approaches in black arts from the first half of the 20th century, where aesthetic references were at least of equal importance to the political references in the context of the more radical decolonization movements and after the war, of course, the aesthetic plays a less important role. After World War II, in accordance with the politics of liberation, both in the colonies and in the US, the focus is on the political interpretation of African art in Western collections and on the idea to liberate or to recapture these objects that were later on famously described as hostages in Fred Wilson's work, The Colonial Collection of 1990. A prominent case regarding the connection of calls for restitution of African art objects in Western museums to artistic projects of symbolic repossession came up in 1977 on the occasion of the Second World Festival of Black Arts and Culture in Lagos. FESTAC had chosen the image of a 16th century ivory mask from the Benin court as the emblem of the festival. When Nigeria's request for a contemporary loan of this mask for the duration of the festival was rejected by the British Museum, discussions on the rightful place of African artworks in a post-colonial era intensified. As many of you might know, the Benin artworks stored in several European museums derive from a military expedition of the British against the Benin Kingdom in 1897 and the looting of thousands of artworks from the King's Palace. What is less known than the case of the Festac mask itself is the fact that these debates and the anger they caused on the Nigerian side also provided the motive for a movie whose subject is the recapture of a Benin mask from a British museum. Nigerian film director Eddie Ukpoma released his film, The Mask, in 1979. It stages the secret mission of a Nigerian James Bond-like hero commissioned by a fictitious Nigerian president and played by Ukpoma himself, to break into the British Museum to rescue the mask from its imprisonment in an imperial institution and return it back to its country of provenance. Film historian Nwachukwu Frank Ukadike mentions Ukpoma's political intentions, quoting the director as follows. So this is a quote of Ukpoma. "The British stole our treasures. They felt the impact of the film's message, and hence the BBC was forced to make the program called Whose Treasure, Ours or Theirs? As a counter response. I was flown to London to discuss the topic when it was aired on BBC. While this film can be understood as a direct intervention of an artist into the issue of restitution of African art, I would like to focus on a more symbolic reading of African sculptures in the post-colonial setting, as it has been proposed by other artists. Interestingly enough, there is another film about the return of a mask from Europe to Africa that premiered and was prized at the Premier Festival des Arts Nègres, hosted by Leopold Sédar Senghor in Dakar in 1966. In fact, the intercontinental round-trip travel of a piece of African art is the subject of the very first feature film made by an African, sub-Saharan African film director. La Noire, as it is called, the Black Girl in English, by Senegalese filmmaker Ousmane Sembène, was released only a few years after Senegal gained its independence from French colonial rule. The manifest narrative of Black Girl, as the film is titled in English, tells the tragic story of a young Senegalese woman who has been working as a nurse for a French family in Dakar and afterwards joins the family's household in Antibes. Hired as a nanny, but forced into domestic work, confined to the family's apartment and her workplace and humiliated by her employers and their guests, Joanna, the name of the woman, finally commits suicide, the only solution she sees to regain her self-determination. Based on a brief newspaper report about such an incident, La Noire is a cinematic commentary on the seamless transformation from colonialism via decolonization to neocolonialism. The colonizers, here the French family, have left the colonial space after independence, but they still exercise the racialized power structures established during colonial times. As indicated in the film's title, La Noire, which is the black from, is about the objectification of the African subject, not so much about any object. However, an object is the protagonist of the film's subtext. The mask hanging on the wall and noticed by Joanna when she first enters the French family's apartment in Antibes had been, as we realize only later in a retrospect, had been a gift that she had offered to her employers back in Dakar, where the wooden mask immediately found its place in the couple's private collection of objets nègres. When close to the end of the film, Joanna prepares herself to escape from her imprisonment in the French household. Packing a suitcase with her few belongings, she demounts the mask from the wall and takes it to her bedroom. After a heavy fight over the mask with her mistress, Joanna puts it onto her suitcase. After Joanna's suicide, her master travels to Dakar to deliver her belongings to Joanna's mother. On arrival, he offers her some money that Joanna's mother wordlessly refuses to accept. When the Frenchman leaves the neighborhood of the Medina, Joanna's little brother is following him. He has picked up the mask to cover his own face. The final scene dramatizes the escape of the colonizer from the natives' quarters, scared and chased by the mask haunting him. Contrary to the aforementioned Nigerian film of 1979 that can be read as an artistic contribution to debates about restitution, Ousmane Sembène tells an allegorical tale of post-independence power structures and the African effort to resist the ex-colonizer's attempt to buy his way out of historic guilt. When the Nigerian hero in The Mask is concerned with a specific object of cultural value to his community, which he tries to set free and let go back from its forced diasporic location to its homeland, he offers an imaginary compensation for the actually denied return ticket of the exiled mask. Zimbain's mask, in contrast, doesn't have the given status of a cultural treasure. It was not even stolen by the colonizers, but presented as a gift from the recently liberated African to the European. The journey of the mask from Senegal to France and back to Senegal is depicted not only as a travel in space, but also in changing status and meanings. The mask has its first appearance as nothing but the children's toy, the child's toy, until Joanna buys it from her little brother to present it to her employers. In the European living room, placed among other objects, the mask becomes an artwork of almost aesthetic value, or of mostly aesthetic value. Zimbain actually includes a note on the issue of authenticity that figures so prominently in the discourse on so-called tribal art. Comparing the new piece to other objects in their modest collection, the Frenchman says to his wife, "It looks like the real thing." After being recaptured by the African woman, the mask changes status again, this time from an exotic object of contemplation to a symbol of home and identity. Back in Africa and performed by the boy, the mask finally gains magic power, haunting the escaping white man. In the historical context of post-independent Senegal of the mid-1960s, which is repeatedly addressed throughout the film, the mask, which has been recaptured from its misuse as aesthetic decoration of neo-colonial power relations, is employed as a symbolic force to effectively expel the colonizer. Zimbain's film casts a sharp light on post-colonial labor migration to Europe in the 1960s, connecting it to a critique of economic dependency of the newly decolonized African countries. As I run out of time, I just give you the last example of my tour de force, without words, I would say. This is a rap video by French group IAM from 1991. And we can, maybe if we have time, talk about it later on. It's, as you will see, an interesting, with a distance, a historical distance of maybe 40 years, reference to Chris Macaire and Alain René's film about you already know about. So we need a lot of sound. If you can get some good.
Ils sont arrivés un matin par dizaines, par centaines. Sur des montres de bois, aux entrailles de chêne. Sans bonjour ni question, pas même de présentation. Ils se sont installés, ils sont devenus les patrons. Ils se sont transformés en véritables sauvages, jusqu'à les humilier au plus profond de leur âme. Enfants battus, vieillards, tués, mutilés. Femmes salies, insultées et déshonorées. Impuissants, ils ont marché, les subissaient. Les douloureuses lamentations de leur peuple opprimé. Et chacun d'entre eux, en lui-même, se doutait. Ils partaient pour un voyage dont ils ne rentreraient jamais. Qu'ils finiraient dans un port pour y être vendus. Ils pleuraient déjà son pays perdu. Traités en inférieur à cause d'une différence de couleur. Chaque jour nouveau était annonciateur de malheur. Au fond des cales où on les entassait. Dans leurs esprits, les images défilaient. L'âme au pouce allée, l'âme ensanglantée. Dans leurs esprits longtemps retentiraient les chants de la partie de leur rêve qu'on leur a arraché. Mais sans jamais tuer l'espoir qui les nourrissait. Qu'un jour ils retrouveraient ces rivages féeriques où s'élève à jamais les tam-tams de l'Afrique. Sur une estrade, groupée comme du bétail, jetée de droite à gauche, tel des fétus de pas et qui leur ont inculqué que leur couleur était un crime. Ils leur ont tout volé jusqu'à leurs secrets les plus intimes. Piller leur culture, brûler leurs racines de l'Afrique du Sud jusqu'aux rives du Nil. Et à présent pavoisent les usurpateurs, ceux qui ont un bloc de granit à la place du cœur. Ils se moquaient des pleurs et semaient la terreur au sein d'un monde qui avait faim, froid et peur et qui rêvait de courir dans les plaines. Des parfois des gazelles magnifiques. Oh yeah. Quelle était belle la terre qui chérissait, ou à portée de leurs mains poussée de beaux fruits frais qui s'offraient aux bras dorés du soleil. Lui qui inondait le pays de ses étincelles et en fermant les yeux à chaque coup reçu, une voix leur disait que rien n'était perdu. Alors ils revoyaient ces paysages idylliques où résonnaient encore les tam-tams de l'Afrique. Rappelle-leur, my brother, qu'ils gardent une parcelle de leur cœur et que le sang qui a été versé ne l'a été que pour qu'ils puissent exister. Les enfants qui naissaient avaient leur destin tracé. Ils travailleraient dans les champs jusqu'à leur dernière journée. Pour un bas de 4 heures, encore moins de récré. Leurs compagnons de chaque jour étaient la chaleur et le fouet. Sur leur passage, on les fuyait comme le malin. En ces temps-là, il y avait l'homme noir et l'être humain décrété supérieur de par sa blanche couleur, en omettant tout simplement son malheur antérieur. Il assouvissait son instinct dominateur en s'abreuvant de lamentations, de cris, de tristes clameurs qui hantaient les forêts, longtemps après son passage. Et l'esprit de ceux qui finissaient d'esclaves de génération en génération. Crime et destruction, le peuple noir a dû subir les pires abominations. Le tempo libère mon imagination, me rappelle que ma musique est née dans un champ de coton. Mais non, je ne suis pas raciste par mes opinions, non pas de la critique, juste une narration. Je raconte simplement ces contrées fantastiques et je garde dans mon cœur les tam-tams de la paix.
Thank you very much for your attention.